Let the spirit of the Kennedys
and the magic of the Disney brothers be with you always.
Blood and Business Legacy merch, available now.
Let's run faster,
work harder,
burn brighter
before we're gone.
Order your Blood and Business Legacy merch today.
Welcome to Blood and Business.
I'm Bethany.
And I'm Cassie.
Today we're telling a story of siblings born and bred to run the world. They were the most infamous family of the 20th century. Their story drips with conspiracy. Their names whispered through the decades since they left their voices echoing in time and space. Their hands helped mold the America we know, sharing with their country dreams of landing on the moon, freedom for every man. And by example, they inspired generations to reach the highest heights. They played with fire, and only a few survived. Their words ring through our history books, their pretty faces on our television screens, and their signature will forever be stamped on our national identity. They stood in the trenches. We stood beside them. They flashed their diamonds. We flashed our cameras. They had their fun, and we saluted them. They were good. They were evil. They were human. They are
the Kennedy siblings.
The Kennedy unity was undying, without question, never-ending, family above all. Until now. The perfect bond of a family shattered by the favorite daughter. The first real fracture in the Kennedy clan.
Kick and Billy were at a standstill. They sought counsel from every authority on both sides, and still, there was no solution to be found. Billy's Protestant family would not be having a Catholic wedding, and Kick's Catholic family would not tolerate a Protestant wedding. The man who always had all the solutions told her,
"Your top's with me."
You know who that might be?
Her father.
Joe Sr. thought that her personal happiness was more important than which Christian church she attended, and so he wrote,
"I'll bet on your judgment anytime for any amounts."
He even went to the Archbishop Spellman, and Spellman went to the Pope on Kick's behalf, but no luck. Joe Sr. let his daughter know that it was really only an issue between her and Billy. Quote,
"Let all the rest of us go jump in the lake."
That letter from Joe Kennedy, to me, is the biggest evidence that we've had so far, showing just how much he cared about his kids and would forsake public perception in a way in order to either protect them or give them happiness,
right,
or whatever it was. Because previously, and I mean, I don't know if Joe's views changed or not, but it's easy to look at Joe and think it's literally all for money, for power, for fame. And he cared so much about public perception. But there are so many decisions that he made that would have been the wrong decision if you were motivated by the public and what other people thought of you. He, most of the time, chose just what he felt like was right as a father.
To protect his kids. Rose felt quite differently. She had already experienced a significant loss of one daughter and felt that if Kick converted to the Protestant faith, she would be spiritually dead and it would be a loss equivalent to Rosemary. Kick knew that her mom would not listen to her opinion, but she thought she might listen to a respectable British aristocrat. So Kathleen went to Marie Bruce. She was actually one of Rose's personal friends that she had met on her solo travels over the years, and Kathleen asked her to write to her mother. Quote,
"She thinks you would not approve. I think if you saw the pair of them together, you certainly would."
Rose was a woman of the highest standards of manners and etiquette. She did not respond to this letter. She also gave Kick the silent treatment. Kit had always done everything that her parents had asked of her and only what they approved of. But this, she wanted. This, she couldn't walk away from. Whether because Billy genuinely and deeply loved her as no one else ever had, or because he was one of the wealthiest and most important men in England, I can't be too sure. But it wasn't a matter of brushing it off and moving on like Jack had with Inga. There was something much greater here. And this is where her mom's psychological warfare got a little out of control. Kik wrote to her parents,
"I think something will have to be decided one way or another before we both go nuts. Somehow, I can't make myself see that the Lord in heaven would make things so difficult."
This did not register with her mother at all. Quote,
"When both people have been handed something all their lives, how ironic is it that they cannot have what they want most?"
She wrote to Kik, as if to say, "You poor, poor child. I just can't imagine the loss, the deprivation you must be feeling when your family has quite literally given you everything under the sun." She went on to write,
"I wonder if the next generation will feel that it is worth sacrificing a life's happiness for all the old family tradition."
Rose Kennedy,
"I think I detect a sense of sarcasm from Rose here.
Maybe just a little bit.
The side of her I have not seen yet.
Honestly,
I feel like the girls just know how to rub Rose wrong.
This is like how Jack used to
talk to
Rose.
Yes.
And so now it's her
I
talking to Kit.
God for the...
the sound grammar.
Yeah, I need to memorize that quote. So good.
So good. Billy had his own parental issues. Seems pretty common in the upper classes. Well, seems pretty common. But specifically that his dad had his own plans for Billy's life.
Remember, Billy's father is the one who is an alcoholic and also the one who doesn't really want to be the Duke, but is the 10th Duke of Devonshire. And proud of being the most famous Catholic hater in all of England.
Pretty much. So Billy's dad had not much consideration for Billy. Because the Cavendish family had such a history in politics in England, his dad thought that he should run for the House of Commons in 1944. He had a similar desire for his sons to what Joe Kennedy had. The difference was, Joe Jr. and the rest of the Kennedy kids also wanted that for themselves. Billy did not. Quote,
"He never should have come back,"
Lady Maureen Fellows remembered about the situation.
"He should have stayed with his regiment. He was just too nice. He would never have said, 'Go to hell, Dad.' He didn't want to hurt anyone."
And that tracks with all of the firstborns being people pleasers. Cassie?
Guilty as charged. Billy had joined the British Army at the beginning of the war and found his own purpose in being a part of something bigger, something he truly cared about. He found himself as a, quote,
"man among men,"
according to Lawrence Lehmer. But because he wanted to please his father, he left his troops and returned home to run for office. It was actually pretty disastrous. People could tell he really didn't want to be there. His heart wasn't in it. And he lost by a pretty large margin. People were ruthless, accusing him of poor character, calling him a coward for leaving his infantry, and questioning him on what his family could have done better over the years. It really affected Billy. And to add salt to the wound, Kik was there, supporting Billy on the campaign in person, and thus saw all of it. Billy's younger brother said,
"The by-election was a grave error of judgment on my father's part."
But once it was over, Billy was free to return to what he felt was his true calling. Quote,
"It has been a fierce fight. Now I am going out to fight for you at the front. To fight, perhaps die, for my country."
On the weekends during the spring of 1944, Kik, Joe Jr., Billy, and their friends gathered in a cottage outside a little town in southern England. The cottage belonged to Pat Wilson, and she was living there with her three children while her husband was away fighting in the war. They all brought food and games, and it was chill and low-key, but Kick cherished these times. Joe Jr. also may or may not have been in love with Pat Wilson, the mother of the three children who owned the cottage, whose husband was away at war. Kick was uncomfortable with the situation, but there was such an air of apocalypse and that it was all temporary. I think she chose to ignore the morally corrupt nature of the situation in the name of, all together now, fun. She took advantage of the time with her big brother and got to know a side of him that she had never seen before. He had a deep personal faith himself and was never afraid to get down on his knees and pray, no matter who was around. Tough Navy men or his kid sister or the future Duke of Devonshire. It was also, allegedly, his practical Catholic denomination and culture, or maybe it was his family's interpretation of it, that allowed for such deep faith to coexist in an imperfect world alongside his questionable decisions, especially when it came to love. This part is a bit confusing and hard for me to fully understand because I definitely was not raised this way. But in the Kennedys, the women were expected to live a life of duty with a disregard for their own personal happiness in a different manner than the men. The book, The Kennedy Women, says, quote,
"Thus, if Kathleen went against the dictates of her parents, Rose could only conclude that a man must be providing the backbone behind her daughter's decision."
Because she can't make a decision for herself.
She would never be doing that on her own.
Kick wrote this about her big brother.
"Moral courage he, Joe Jr., had in abundance, and once he felt that a step was right for me, he never faltered, although he might be held largely responsible for my decision."
So Joe was supporting her relationship with Billy in a way that no one else in the family was. And it sounds like everybody knew that. Because a woman couldn't make her own poor decision, it had to be a man's fault.
You just said that Joe Jr. was the only one supporting Kick and Billy's relationship, but wasn't Joe Sr. as well?
Yeah, he did. So I'm not sure why Joe Jr. is specifically getting so much responsibility. Maybe her dad was more saying, "I'll love you either way, and of course I want you to be happy, so make your decision and then I'll be okay with it." Where Joe Jr. was more, "Don't listen to mom. You love Billy. You need to be with him." Like more pushing
for it.
Yeah. The relationship. I'm not positive. Rose also seems to be forced to ignore a lot of her husband's shortcomings and things that she doesn't agree with. So maybe it was just simply that.
Yeah. Denial. Or it could also be the proximity, because Joe Jr. was with Kick when all of this was going on. And Joe Sr. was kind of removed from the situation and just writing to Kick from afar.
And who knows what Rose knew that Joe Sr. was even saying. Billy was adamant about raising his future children in the Church of England. Kick wanted to marry Billy. She couldn't figure out how to get past this deadlock. But she felt that maybe they were just making too big a deal out of this, right? Maybe the right outside perspective would ease her anxieties and reassure her that everyone was just being a bit dramatic. So she reached out for more counsel. She consulted a priest that she knew had converted many more so worldly people and was thinking that he may be able to understand her position better because he spent so much time with those outside their religion. But instead of holding a lenient opinion, he reminded her of the spiritually desolate life and godless eternity that lay before her if she made the decision to marry Billy.
Why is this reminding me of the Fox sisters?
Oh my gosh. A spiritually desolate life. If Kick married Billy, she would, according to her faith, be living in sin and unable to make confession or receive Holy Communion, which would separate her from what she believed was the one true faith. When she died, she would be eternally damned. in this situation, her only chance was that if Billy died before her, so that she could be absolved or freed of the guilt of being married to a non-Catholic, and she could be forgiven before death. If she died first, she was done. This is also what Rose believed and why she was so strongly opposed to it. But Kick, to a certain extent, did believe this, and so it was a horrific idea in her mind. The idea that she would be truly disconnected and living out of the will of God was horrifying. But she also couldn't imagine a life without Billy. She just wanted someone to tell her that it wasn't true.
She's literally going to the priest, to her mom's friend, to literally anyone that she can get to say, yeah, you're fine. Clearly, she already made up her mind.
Billy would not give an inch, and neither would her mother. She must make her choice. Her life in America with her family and everything she had believed her entire existence since she was a little girl, or her new life here with William Cavendish, Duke of Devonshire, and everything she had chosen herself as an adult woman. On May 4th, 1944, William and Kathleen announced their engagement. Rose checked herself into a hospital. Literally. She claimed that she was going in for a routine checkup the day after they announced their engagement, but she was using it as a safe haven from the media and the reality of all that was happening. The Boston Traveler published on the day before Kathleen's wedding that the marriage, quote,
will bring her,
Kathleen,
into a family prominent in the defense and spread of Protestantism throughout the British realm.
It was like someone had stabbed Rose right through the heart.
This is less than 3 years after Rosemary had her lobotomy or disappeared, and Jack and Joe Jr. are now in combat in World War II, so she's terrified every day that she might never see them again. And then Kick goes and does this, so it's like she's already lost all four of her oldest children.
And she's probably thinking, one by one, here they go down the line, when is it ever going to stop?
She's losing all sense of control.
She feels like she's failing.
Yeah.
Rose was on the verge of losing it. She sent a telegraph to her daughter. All caps, quote,
heartbroken, period. Feel you have been wrongly influenced, dash. Sending Arch Spellman's French to talk to you, period. Anything done for our Lord will be rewarded hundredfold, period.
It's like her last ditch effort. Ugh.
Lawrence Lehmer noted that Joe Jr. and Joe Sr. both saw that this rigid interpretation of her Catholic faith made the mechanics and the laws of their religion more important than the spiritual side of their faith and relationship with God. They believed that they knew the depth of Kathleen's faith, and they could not imagine their forgiving God banishing her from heaven for a legalistic reason like this.
Gosh.
Rose may have also been concerned about the appearance of the family's standing with God rather than the actuality of their faith. Quote,
I thought it would have such mighty repercussions in that every little girl would say, if Kathleen Kennedy can, why can't I? Everyone pointed to our family with pride as well-behaved, level-headed, and deeply religious. What a blow to family prestige.
No matter that Joe Sr. so blatantly went against the Bible's teaching almost every day of his life, and that everyone knew it, nor that Jack had an affair with a twice married Inga Binga, or that in England, Joe Jr. was in a relationship with a currently married woman. For these were the sins of men. Kathleen was her daughter, and Kennedy women were held to a different standard. Kennedy women had duties. Regardless of her mother's emotional absence, or maybe as a response, Joe Jr. stepped up as Kick's supporter and companion. He took the train to London and met with the Cavendish's lawyer and convinced him that Kick didn't need to sign a paper agreeing to raise her children as Anglican Protestants because she had already given her verbal promise. He also confronted Rose, his mom, and exposed himself and his love affair to try to protect his little sister.
We can talk about this more in the KFMs, but Joe Jr. continues to impress me with how freaking good of a big brother he was. That is who he was meant to be.
He knew how important her mother was to her, and if he could help put the situation into perspective, he was willing to sacrifice his own standing with the family and with society to do it.
This also backs up my theory that the Kennedys knew, all of the men knew, that their affairs were wrong. And if it's not wrong, then what is there to out yourself for?
I stand corrected. At least Joe Jr. Jack, I'm still not convinced. Joe Jr. wrote to the family.
As far as Kick's soul is concerned, I wish I had half her chance of seeing the pearly gates. As far as what people will say, the hell with them. I think we can all take it. It will be the hardest on Mother, and I do know how you feel, Mother. But I do think it will be all right.
Kick and Billy were married 2 days after they announced their engagement. On the morning of May 6th, 1944, Kick went to the Chelsea Register office with only her big brother there to support her. She wanted her day to be special. She wanted it to have an elegance and reflect her own style, even if it was going to be in a government office in the middle of a world war. The day before, a friend, Marie Bruce, that woman that had
been friends with Rose.
Right. And then wrote on Kick's behalf to her mother.
Who Rose never replied to.
Correct. Well, she and Kick had become close throughout Kick's time in England, and she had a new pink dress made for Kick for her wedding day. Kick picked out a half hat that had blue and pink ostrich feathers and a pink veil. Something new and something blue. Her something old was Marie Bruce's old gold mesh bag, and the diamond brooch she wore, also from Marie, was her something borrowed. She carried a bouquet of pink camellias, fresh from the Chatsworth garden, and allegedly even her underwear was borrowed from Marie.
That's so sad to me that this is how she chose to go about things, because her family did mean so much to her, even though she was going against them. And I just wouldn't feel right, because she's so close to them. No matter what, I wouldn't feel right going about it with just one of my brothers there when her and Jack were so close.
It's so rushed. She's not at home. She doesn't have any of her people. She doesn't even have any of her belongings. She doesn't even have her own underwear. You would think with how much she liked to party, she would want a big
wedding. That's why it doesn't make sense to me. I feel like something had to have, and maybe he got drafted, or because he goes off to war, like what, 2 weeks later or something? 2 days later?
A few weeks,
yeah. Super quickly afterwards. So maybe they knew that and they were like, okay, well, we just need to get married before I go off to war. Because then maybe Billy thought her family's going to change her mind.
I'm thinking.
Yeah. I bet that's what it is, because she's very
calculated.
Very calculated. We need to talk about that in the KFMs, I guess.
Billy had several guests that morning. His parents came from Chatsworth. His two younger sisters were there. His aunt, and a friend standing in as his best man. Kick could have invited some of her London friends, but she only asked Marie Bruce and Lady Astor, both older women that she respected. Obviously, Joe Jr. was there as well. The ceremony was quick. Joe Jr. gave his little sister away, and with no vows read, the ceremony was over within 10 minutes. A lot of the accounts from the people who were there that day say that this is how Kick wanted it, that she and Billy were so happy and that she could have been married in front of 1,000 guests at Chatsworth and worn an extravagant white gown, but maybe because of the war, the fact that most weddings and births and events that usually call for huge celebrations were all stripped to their bare bones in Europe during World War II, or maybe because of her family's absence, this is what she chose. Marie Bruce wrote to Rose, quote,
"You would rejoice in their young happiness."
No, she obviously wouldn't.
Again, because of the war, it was not the time to be wasting food in Europe. So instead of throwing rice, the guests threw rose petals as the bride and groom exited the building. They did get to have a reception right after the ceremony, and they had 200 guests in attendance. Afterward, Billy and Kick hopped on a train and retreated to the privacy of one of their family estates for a short honeymoon before Billy headed back to war.
This doesn't make sense. Why get married?
And that is exactly what our conspiracy is going to be for this KFM. Because when Kick married Billy, she knew she was doing more than just marrying Billy. But also, being inducted to a role that she was well prepared for. The Boston Globe ran full stories on Kick, saying that
as the next Duchess of Devonshire, she will take rank next to the Queen as the most powerful woman in England.
Her many friends that she had made over the years were kind, though. They wrote congratulating her and remembering good times spent together. Kick had pretty much nothing to do besides ride her bike around the countryside and listen to the other wives gossip while their husbands were away at war. Being apart was even harder on Billy. When he first got orders to return to the battlefield, he wrote to Kick that their honeymoon had been, quote,
"the most perfect month. How beastly it is to be ending things. This love seems to cause nothing but goodbye. I think that is the worst part of it. Even worse than fighting."
I was wondering if Billy realized what all this marriage meant for Kick.
How much she had to sacrifice.
Yeah, but it sounds like he did.
Joe Jr. knew how much distress Kick was in the day after her wedding and wrote to his parents,
"The power of silence is great."
Joe Sr. immediately wrote back,
"With your faith in God, you can't make a mistake. Remember, you are still and always will be tops with me."
When Kick received this telegram, she immediately ran to the telegraph office and sent this message back.
"Your cable made my happiest day. Most distressed about mother. Please tell her not to worry."
3 days after she got married, Kick sat down to write her mom. Quote,
"Now every morning, letters arrive condemning my action. They don't bother me at all, and I only hope and pray that things will not be too difficult for you and the rest of the family."
She couldn't be too down knowing that her big brother was so on her side. Everything would blow over. Everything would be all right. The day that Kick learned that Joe Jr. had died, Mark Sodden contacted her to tell her that Joe Jr. had divided up his belongings before he flew his last mission, and he left an Underwood typewriter to her, the one that they had always fought over, along with a Victrola, a Zenith radio, and a Zeiss camera. She cried on the phone with Sodden while he read the list to her, and she wrote to him,
"I am so sorry I broke down tonight. It never makes things easier."
As soon as she heard the news, she wanted to be at home. And home was with her family in Hyannisport. Joe Sr. arranged for an army transport plane to take her back to the U.S. Some people said that now that she was married to Billy, it was unbecoming to leave England while her husband fought in France. She left England almost immediately. Her plane landed on August 16th, 1944. At Logan Airport in Boston, where a skinny Jack stood waiting on the tarmac. She ran as fast as she could into his arms and began weeping.
"Kennedys never cry."
Remember, they were the two that came up with that little slogan to poke fun at their father.
"Don't come in here second or third, but win."
When Cassie first read the script to me, I thought it was so interesting that Kick was allowed to come home in the first place and that they were so accepting of her coming back home. From reading headlines, I had definitely gotten the gist that they completely like cut off contact. Joe Jr. was the only one at her wedding and the Kennedys like basically disowned her after she got married, but that's not the case.
The very next day after Kick landed in the U.S., Jack had rectal surgery that alleviated some of his back pain, but did nothing for his digestive system. He was in rough shape. He had a big open wound on his back from the operation. He was close to skeletal, and because he had picked up a good case of malaria in the Pacific, he was quite yellow. Kick was very concerned when she got home, but his parents hardly even noticed. Joe Sr. was physically there, but mentally and emotionally, he was with Joe Jr. He sat alone for hours on end every day, and even when Jack brought war friends around on Labor Day weekend, he barely came out of his room.
I actually found some family album photos of this weekend with the Kennedys and all of his Navy friends, so I'll put those in the home video.
After her son died, Rose went to Mass every single morning. She was desperate for the peace she knew she could only find in the one who created her and created Joe Jr. and was above all the suffering of the human experience. But she still could not forgive her daughter. Kick had once called her
the dearest mother in the world.
And now they could not speak. Kick was always the life of the party. Her whole life, she shined and laughed with reckless freedom. Now, she was quiet. Once the kids grew up, Rose and Joe only allowed one cocktail before dinner. Remember from the second episode, I think? It was like, no alcohol allowed in the Kennedy home. You can have Boston cream pie and fruit.
I think it's the first episode.
Well, one day, Bobby bounced into the kitchen and found Jack and Kick splitting a bottle of scotch with Red Faye and a few other military friends. They had been out playing golf that day, and it was their first time reuniting since they were rescued from their island after their PT boat sank. Bobby immediately stopped staring at them in his white, starched Navy uniform. And though he knew they were adults who had just come back from combat in defense of our country, without hesitation, said,
"I'm telling Dad."
Kick told him to leave and mind his own business. But later that night, Kick, Jack, and his military buddies were all sitting outside and reminiscing, telling stories about the ridiculous things that happened in the midst of fighting for our country. You know, the kind of stories that get brought up dozens of times, but never get old. Well, they're all out on the lawn cackling. And then above their heads, a window pops open and Joe Sr. leans out shouting,
"Jack, don't you and your friends have any respect for your dead brother? You get in here. You're making a nuisance of yourself with the neighbors."
Like he was 12 years old, not 27 and a war vet. Jack knew that in the wake of a tragedy like this, being a Kennedy and a man meant that he could not laugh, nor could he cry. Everyone was kind of just sitting there in stunned silence when Bobby runs outside and says,
"Dad's awfully mad."
Oh my God. Kathleen whipped her head around and pierced Bobby with a stern look of a big sister and said,
"You're frightening our house guests out of their wits."
I'm not sure if this was directed more so at Bobby or her father. Billy was in combat during all of this, and he had his own war glory. He was an officer, and his unit was one of the first to liberate Brussels. He rode into the city on top of a tank, waving to the cheering, grateful citizens of Belgium. He wrote to Kick that he felt
so unworthy of it all, living as I have in reasonable safety and comfort during these years. I have a permanent lump in my throat that I long for you to be here, as it is an experience which you can have and which I would love to share with you.
Back in the States, Kathleen was shopping the second floor of a department store with an armful of matching suits and accessories when Eunice showed up to meet her for their lunch date. Eunice whispered to Kick,
"Before we go, I think we ought to go back and talk to Daddy."
Kick responded,
"Something's happened. Why don't you go and talk to Daddy?"
Eunice insisted. She was pale, and it seemed like there was a knot in her throat. She led Kick back to the Waldorf Astoria, where he was staying, and when they got to the room, Joe Sr. shut the door and told Kick quickly and simply that Billy was dead. Billy fought with a disregard for danger in a similar way to Joe Jr. Being an officer, he was allowed to wear a uniform that was different than his men, and in a defiance of the enemy, he chose a glowing white coat and bright colored pants. He charged forward at the front of his platoon, even after losing a quarter of his men in one day.
"Come on, you fellows, buck up,"
he would shout to his men. Then, on September 9th, 1944, a farmer and his son returned to their farm after fleeing an active attack. Among the bodies they found was a clean-shaven man wearing brightly colored pants in pristine condition, other than a single small bullet hole in his white coat right through his heart. At dinner the night that Kick heard the news, the Kennedy family talked about anything and everything but Billy. Eunice normally couldn't breathe enough to keep up with her speech, but tonight she had nothing to say. Joe Sr. asked Kick if there was a friend that she would want to come stay with her, and Kick said that she would like to be with Patsy Field. Remember John White, the reporter from the Times Herald?
Mm-hmm.
This is actually his sister. She wasn't Kick's closest friend, but she was an older woman and had experience and wisdom that was deeper than Kick's peers. At midnight, Joe Sr. placed a call to the Field residence. Quote,
"I hate your guts, as you well know, but I have a favor to ask of you. Will you come and stay with Kathleen?"
Patsy and her husband were much more progressive than Joe Kennedy, and Protestant, by the way, as well as John White. But in keeping with his parenting that he had implemented since Kick was a little girl, trudging out in the snow with her big brothers, bad influences didn't matter much to Joe. He trusted Kick to be independent like she always had been. It only mattered that she come out on top, that she'd be all right. Patsy arrived in New York the very next day, and after greeting Joe Sr. at the Waldorf, landed at the Plaza Hotel, where Rose and all of the kids were staying. She described that she noticed immediately upon stepping into the room that, quote,
"A great cloud of misery was hanging over everything."
The Kennedy ladies had made a mess of it, strung their clothes all over the suite, and Kick sat on the floor in the middle of everything. Patsy asked her what she had been doing since she received the news.
"Mostly going to Mass,"
Kick replied.
"Mother keeps saying, God doesn't send us a cross heavier than we can bear. Again and again she keeps saying it."
Kick and Patsy talked about nothing and everything for 2 hours that day. About Girdles and Jack and England and America and about Billy. Kick said that her only regret was that she was not pregnant with their child. Quote,
"The amazing thing was that Billy loved me so much, Patsy. I felt needed. I felt I could make him happy."
She had 5 short weeks as his wife. That night, Joe invited everyone to a French restaurant and handed out Broadway tickets like party favors. Leave it to Dad to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm.
"So ends the story of Billy and Kick,"
she wrote in her diary on September 20th, 1944, 11 days after he passed.
"I can't believe that the one thing I feared most should have happened. Life is so cruel."
On the last day of September, she flew back to England to be with Billy's family and to attend his memorial service. Billy was not buried in the family plot behind the church where centuries of Cavendish's rest, but instead in a field alongside his men. Kick received nothing but a small $5,000 inheritance from Billy's death. Chatsworth was confiscated and handed back to the family since she had not provided Billy with a male heir.
That is wild. Also kind of like the Ringling Brothers.
Oh, yeah. Alone in England, Kick was able to fully grieve the loss of her husband. She stayed with Billy's parents and sisters for several weeks, and outside of
Kennedy's never cry
earshot, she allowed herself to wail. She couldn't sleep alone, so Billy's sister Elizabeth offered to sleep with her. That reminds me of Jackie mm-hmm. and Lee after Jack died. Elizabeth remembered from that time that she had, quote,
"never met anyone so desperately unhappy. Her mother had tried to convince her that she had committed a sin in this marriage, so in addition to losing her husband, she worried about having lost her soul.
Kick returned to the Catholic Church, and as much as Rose felt the bitter sting of death herself, she also saw a divine correction taking place. She could see God's plan in Joe Jr.'s death and in her Protestant son-in-law's. Quote,
"I guess God has taken care of the matter in his own way, hasn't he?"
she wrote to a friend. Jack was putting together his memorial book, As We Remember Joe, and asked Kick for help. She wrote all that she remembered and loved about her big brother, the things that she had learned about him recently, and the things that she had admired her entire life. The memory that stuck out to her the most, though, was his understanding and support of her relationship with Billy. When no one else was there, he was. She wasn't sure something like that should go in the book, though, so she told Jack,
"Do what you think."
He kept every word. Kick didn't like being out in public after Joe Jr. and Billy passed. The once exhilarating fame had turned wicked with the events in her life. She felt people everywhere side-eyeing her, quote,
"Looking to see how I'm taking it."
There's a story that she went out to sign up for the rations in England after deciding to stay, even though there was nothing really tying her there anymore. She still felt she belonged with the English. The line was long that day, and so she sat down on a chair near the end. A woman said to her,
"You look like Mr. Kennedy's daughter." "I am,"
Kick replied. The woman was poor, and so she responded,
"Of course, the likes of you would never speak to the likes of me. We're all the same in God's eyes,"
Kick replied, as if she was genuinely disappointed and maybe even a bit surprised that she had found that to be true. But she did write to Lem about one privilege she inherited in being born a Kennedy. Quote,
"The ability to not be got down."
She had made herself a home in England. She rented a 3-story townhouse in London, decorated it with antiques, hired a housekeeper and a cook, and in her living room, she displayed an 8x10 photo of all 11 Kennedys. It was a photo taken just before the war, in the short time when all 11 Kennedys were English. The time in her life when she'd had everything she wanted. Her family and England, and so much hope for what was ahead. In the summer of 1946, on a sunny day after the war was over, Kick went out with a friend, Jane Compton. She looked out over London and said,
"It's such a wonderful day. You don't think Billy would mind if I wore a really flowery dress, do you?"
Kick was tired of all the gray, ready not to move on from Billy and Joe Jr. and war, but to move forward, bringing their memories with her into a brighter day.
They were at the helm during the most turbulent moment in American history. The rumors are legion. Some sincere, some slander. They gave everything to their country. But what did it look like behind closed doors, in their homes? The most intimate moments of their time on Earth. Sometimes the truth is more wild than the headlines. They seemed to live the easy life, but they lost it all in an instant. They ran faster, worked harder, burned brighter, and then they were gone.
You have just listened to The Kennedy Siblings,
Episode 8.
From Blood and Business.
Thank you all for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please give us a review on Apple, rate us on Spotify, and share Blood and Business with a friend or a sibling. If you'd like to support the show, the best way is to become a patron of Blood and Business. You will get bonus content every month, including a monthly bonus episode, interactive main episodes, and behind-the-scenes footage.
To keep up with us day-to-day, you can follow us at Blood and Business on Instagram and TikTok. You can find the link for Instagram, TikTok, and Patreon in the show notes below.
Thank you so much for the support, and we will see you back here next week for your regularly scheduled programming on
Blood and Business.
The main source for this episode was The Kennedy Women by Lawrence Lehmer. To see a complete list of sources for all Blood and Business episodes, head on over to Patreon for a free PDF download.